Do not let your hearts be troubled or afraid. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Spirit is with you.
I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love.
And welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host for the next hour, Ken Johnston, and look forward to sharing our guest with you, who will join us in just a minute. Before we get there, I just want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners today. Thank you for being with us and taking time out of your schedules to spend a little time with us. Hopefully you have time to spend the hour with us, but whatever portion of that hour, it's great to have you. Coming up on Sunday, April the 22nd, is going to be our Wake Up America dinner. That's going to be at the St. Joseph's in the Hills Retreat House, also known as the Malvern Retreat House here in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Again, Sunday, April 22nd from 1:30 to 5:30. The cost is $55 per person, or you can get a table of eight for $400 and save a few dollars. It's one of our two big fundraisers of the year. We have a golf outing in the fall, and each spring now we have this Wake Up America dinner where we'll break bread and have a delicious meal together, as well as a couple of speakers, silent auction, and other opportunities to help us out financially to keep this radio apostolate going, one that's been on the air now for over 40 years, and we want to keep that going. So you can call Maureen here, 610-527-2906, 610-527-2906 for your reservations. I've also been given a copy of the flyer that I'll be able to put on the website, so that should be available if not tonight, by tomorrow night. I'll get that uploaded on the website. So without any further ado, our guest today is Mr. Stephen Wolf, and he's the vice postulator for the cause for canonization of Father Edward Flanagan, the founder of Boys Town, who is now in the going through the canonization process. Stephen has a whole litany of things, man, that he's done, but he's the founder and president of Issues Management Solutions, a national-level consulting firm that is focused on public affairs, government relations, and strategic organizational issues management. That was founded in 2001. He's also served as the executive director of the Nebraska Business Leaders Summit, director of community relations, U.S. Strategic Command, chief of environmental public affairs for the National Guard Bureau at the Pentagon, and a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel in Florida. He has served the Army National Guard and currently in the Army Reserve since 1980, with his current position with the Office of the Chief, Army Reserve, Pentagon in Washington, D.C. So welcome to In His Sign Radio, Stephen. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's great to be with you and your listeners, and I think you just exhausted me and your listeners with that introduction, so thank you for that.
No problem. But what I didn't, and this comes off your website, obviously, that at Flanagan.org, or FatherFlanagan.org, the next paragraph begins with, upon graduation from Boys Town High School. So is that high school part of Boys Town, or is it because Boys Town has become so big in the Omaha area that they now have a high school for that area named Boys Town?
No, it's actually one of the wonderful things that Father Flanagan did. He did not just only have this mission, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. He actually did create a city of, you know, at the time they kind of referred to it as the City of Little Men, and it's actually an incorporated village of the state of Nebraska, and it has its own high school, and it has the middle school for the younger age kids that are there. And so I happen to be one of the recipients of Father Flanagan's love and his mission work here in this world. And I'm very honored to live there and be a student there and graduate from Boys Town High School.
Very good. As I mentioned just before we came on the air, I'm part of another organization called the Calix Society. We had our convention at Creighton. It's probably 5 or 6 years ago now. And part of that retreat that we made out there for the weekend, they took us up to Boys Town for a little tour and a meal, and just incredible place. I mean, it's a little different now, I think, than it was when he first envisioned it and first started it. It's no longer just for boys, right?
Correct. They've had girls on campus there now since about 1980. Mm. And they live in separate houses with a family, like a married couple, and same with the boys. They call that family living, and so they have adult role models that show what a loving, caring relationship is like, with a married couple there, and they live like families.
Yeah, and that's how it was explained to us when we were there, and really a great idea and just a beautiful situation, especially to help kids that aren't as fortunate as others. So Father Flanagan is probably the main topic we're going to talk about today, but actually came from Ballymoe, Ireland. And how did he end up coming to the United States?
Well, I think you could see in the time frame in the late 1880s, and then he finally got over to the States in the early 1900s. There was obviously a mass migration from Ireland into the United States and some other countries. They certainly had some very difficult economic situations going on there. Father Flanagan was preceded. He's one of 11 kids, and he was preceded in coming to the United States by his brother, P.A. Flanagan, who was a priest. And he had a sister that was here and some other family were here. And so he ended up, coming over, at the invitation of them, saying, hey, we think we've got some opportunities over here for you. And he stayed in New York for a period of time and then ultimately followed his brother out to Omaha, Nebraska.
Very good. So sounds like he may have been a pretty smart guy. It looks like he came over in 1904, and then he would graduate with honors just 2 years later from Mount St. Mary's.
Correct.
Yeah, and we're broadcasting here out of southeastern Pennsylvania, so Mount St. Mary's is only a couple-hour ride from here and a beautiful spot. So he would graduate from Mount St. Mary's and head right from there to the seminary. Is that right?
Right. He went from there to seminary, and interestingly enough, despite the fact that he graduated with honors at that first level, at the seminary, and this happened to him twice while he was in seminary. He went to a couple of different seminaries, including Dunwoody. We believe he was born prematurely, and as a result of that, he suffered through his entire life with respiratory conditions. Mm. And again, we believe that as a result of him being born prematurely. So that was something that oftentimes would set him back. And so he ended up having to leave Dunwoody as a result of his health. And what's ironic about that, and looking at his life and his legacy in hindsight now, is that one of the notes about his departure from the seminary is that they thought he was of average ability. And to, see what he's gone on to do with his life and to persevere through all his health struggles and refusing to be deterred to follow his call to the vocation of the priesthood. There's just one of the examples of his determination and his heroic virtue to serve Christ.
And it was in that move from Dunwoody. Does he go from there to Omaha? Is that the...
Well, it was actually more of a back and forth.
Okay.
So he would, you know, he would approach the local bishop and, you know, try to figure out what seminary he would go to.
Okay. Very good. So eventually he would end up in Omaha. I would say permanent. That was probably where his base was, but he would end up traveling all over the world
yes.
with some of the work that he did. But how about this vision? Where did he come up with this idea to help these wayward boys at Boys Town?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that what really happened to him, so after he was ordained and went back to Omaha, and he was a parish priest and associate pastor at St. Patrick's Parish in Omaha, and he started a smaller town in Nebraska for his very first assignment. But while he was there, I think a couple things really struck him. One, we had a devastating tornado that hit Omaha back then, and he was out there literally helping pick up the dead from the streets. I mean, it was just a horrible storm, and just helping to rebuild the community. And I think that really touched him in working with broken people in a broken city and just trying to help bring people's lives back together from that. Then another thing that certainly was hitting across our country at that time, too, wasn't really the Great Depression, but in the late, you know, like the 1910s up to, you know, right around World War I, 1916, 15, 17, and particularly in Omaha, there were a lot of drifters and homeless men looking for work. And so he saw a need that he felt needed to be filled, and what he did is he set up a kind of a, you know, a shelter, if you will, an overnight type sleeping arrangement called the Workingman's Hotel, so that these drifters and these people kind of looking for work would have a place to get some food and, you know, certainly have a roof over their head, some shelter, and keep them warm. And while he was ministering to these men, he would, you know, really, like he did with almost everybody he met in his life, he would be fully present to them to find out what was going on in their life, what was going on in their heart and in their faith, and just try to be present for them and try to show them Christ. And in these discussions, what he learned is, you know, like, how did I end up being a drifter? How did I end up in, you know, Father Flanagan's Workingman's Hotel? And you know, what the overriding point was is that these men felt like something went awry earlier in their lives. They were either abused as children, they were abandoned as children, they just didn't have very good parenting. Many of these kids were from broken homes where one or two of the parents died. And it was in those conversations with these men that he realized that he felt like he was on the wrong end of trying to minister. And as he put it, he realized his calling was to work with the embryo men, to work with these kids back, you know, work with the kids so that they would not end up in a shelter like he was running. Hmm. And it was from that inspiration that he started reaching out and bringing in youth, and that's kind of where, you know, the rest of the story comes from.
So he has this vision, and he wants to help people. Obviously, while it was his brainchild, his vision, I'm assuming he had to have an awful lot of help in order to get this off the ground.
Yeah, he did. I think one of the wonderful things as you look at this, he did have some of his family members get involved. There were different religious orders of sisters that came in and helped with his program. I think one of the most amazing parts of his story and how he got his home for boys off the ground is that a local Jewish attorney loaned him the money to buy the first house that he started his mission work with kids for. And it's just amazing, you know, to see later on, too, how vocal and supportive he was of the, you know, with the foundation of the Nation of Israel, and working with Mr. Monsky, who was the attorney that helped him out from the very beginning. And Mr. Monsky was very involved, for, you know, from the U.S. side of advocating for the formation of Israel after World War II. So, you know, and I think that the fact that he had that that help from somebody from another faith shaped his mission approach too, because he would take in every child that needed his help, regardless of their religion, regardless of their race. I mean, he was for 1917, he was a radical pioneer for civil rights, and I mean, nobody really was taking in kids with all these diverse backgrounds at that time in our country. And I mean, really quite a radical thing to do, and he was, quite frankly, a little bit on the scandalous side for people in the community that were shocked to see him having whites and blacks and Hispanics and, you know, Jews and Protestants and Catholics all together on one roof, all being treated with the equal type of love that every one of God's children deserves.
Yeah, so this is 50 years prior to the culmination of the civil rights movement here in the United States. So was one of the things, though, you know, reading in preparation for the show was, you know, he didn't have an easy time of it because of that. There were groups both within the church and outside the church that were not too happy with how he was running the show there. And, you know, it sounded like on multiple occasions would actually trying to shut him down. Were they going that far?
Oh, yes. His mission grew to a point where that first house that he bought with the help of Mr. Monsky, that he outgrew that. They went into a place referred to as the German-American Home, which is a building that still stands here in Omaha. And that he had about 300 kids there, and he quickly outgrew that as well. So he was looking for new places where he could expand and maybe even build, you know, from the ground up some new facilities. And absolutely no one in the Omaha area would sell him, rent him or lease him the land or buildings or anything. And ultimately the reason Boys Town exists where it is, and back when it was established in 1921, when he went out and bought Overlook Farm, that was out in the middle of nowhere, and that was the only place he could really get the land. So that's kind of the reason Boys Town is where it is today, is because people did not want what he was doing in their backyard.
Mm. And just from my own experience in being there, the city of Omaha, and I guess I don't know if it's suburbs or what have you, but it's not that far away from civilization now. It's actually part, like you say, part of a community, right?
Oh, it's been totally engulfed and surrounded by the city of Omaha, and you know, it's just this little jewel now, right in the middle of the city.
Very good. And you know, can't help but think of all the children that you know, he helped directly and then helped indirectly through Boys Town over the years. And again, like you mentioned back as far as the early 80s, when it was no longer just for boys, that they were bringing young girls in as well. And really, you know, when they look at today, I'm happen to be involved in the addiction world. And like Father Flanagan, when you talk to people that struggle with addiction, many times it's a direct result of what they have experienced as a youth. And so the problem certainly hasn't gone away. And often, you know, try and figure out ways of, you know, how do we impact children? And a lot of times it's not, you know, they're not broken homes. It could be, you know, homes that aren't that great. But, you know, the basis for life in those younger years really set the tone for where we end up. So, you know, Father Flanagan was definitely on the right page when he started that. So he starts in Omaha, but it wouldn't end there, would it? He would end up being asked to help start similar facilities, similar homes around the world?
Well, yes. So I think a few things, you know, have been an outcrop of his mission work. So he was taking in boys from all over the United States and from other countries, you know, in his lifetime. And, you know, part of his efforts to raise the funds to take care of all these young men, he did go around the country you know, advocating for his program, and then actually was very involved in the kind of the transformation or the reformation of the juvenile justice system in America. Mm. And so he was an advocate for, you know, I mean, he was instrumental in helping our, you know, law enforcement system, our justice system, and public policy leaders understanding that you don't lock kids up with adults to where they, you know, what's being role modeled for them is how to be professional criminals at a later time in life and things like that. So there were things where he was affecting the way America treats its children that transcended just the kids that were under his direct care at Boys Town. So that was one area. And then others would observe what he was doing and certainly seek to emulate his approach to youth care. And I can say a little bit more on that, too, because there's something very unique about what he did. It wasn't that he simply set up another, you know, like another orphanage or something like that. Boys Town's really never been an orphanage. You know, they've had homeless kids there. But these kids have really come from all kinds of different backgrounds, as you already mentioned.
Right.
But what ends up happening is that he ends up becoming recognized as our nation's leading voice on juvenile justice care and reform, and just taking care of disadvantaged kids. And as a result of that, as one huge example, is that at the end of World War II, President Truman had, and he was a counselor to President Roosevelt as well on youth care issues, but by the end of World War II, Father Flanagan was directly approached by President Truman to go over to the Pacific Rim, to the Pacific Theater, and help to establish youth care systems over, you know, in he visited the Philippines, Korea, and he visited every prefecture in Japan. And in fact, the youth care system that exists in Japan today is founded on the model of how to establish that program that Father Flanagan wrote in his report when he was there and working with General MacArthur in the rebuilding of Japan. So he no sooner gets back from Japan, and then he's then again asked by President Truman to then go over to Europe and to help with the war orphan situation in Austria and Germany in particular. And it was while he was in Berlin in 1948 that he passed away of a massive heart attack trying to save those children torn up by the war.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he literally gave his life to save God's children, and he would go anywhere he was needed to do that. And I think you almost have to look at the context of the time and the situation to really understand the magnitude of Father Flanagan, for example, going to Japan in particular. So you understand that the Japanese people and how when people are at war with each other, how they try to dehumanize, you know, their adversaries and things like that. And much of Japan still coming out of the, you know, kind of a feudal code and the Bushido code and things like that, where you treat your enemies as less than human. And it's better to, you know, to kill yourself than to surrender. And so just imagine a country that had been under that influence for centuries and decades and have this white Irish priest going into a Shinto and Buddhist country and a vanquished foe, if you will, and trying to go in there and help these people. And but when Father Flanagan arrived there, I mean, they had derogatory terms for someone of his, you know, of his type. And by the time he left, they had a title of, you know, of someone of an esteemed, exalted position. But when we defeated Japan, and instead of rubbing their nose in their defeat, we poured out our hearts and our treasure to help rebuild those people and their society and their country. And who, out of a population of 200 million people, who did President Truman decide to send to show them mercy and love and healing to help them with their youth care situation? They, you know, they didn't send, and no offense to the PhDs from Harvard and all these other places, they sent this simple Irish priest from little village, in, you know, from Ballymoe, Ireland, to represent an entire nation to bring, you know, healing and hope to those kids.
Wow. And you can see God's hand in all this. And on the website, there was even the quote before he passed in Berlin saying that the work will continue. You see whether I'm there or not, because it's God's work, not mine. And while that's true, so many things in life are a direct result of God's hand, and you know, things will carry on with or without those that found them. But it took a man like Father Flanagan who saw a need, and I'm sure in his prayer life discerned what God wanted him to do, and acted on it. And because he did, and did it so well, that I think it's only through that he knew that everything that he had started would be taken care of by God, and it really has been, to the point today where you know, the number of missions not only in the United States but around the world, and the impact that he's had.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there are over, you know, in his lifetime and after his passing, over 80 programs around the world were established, founded on his models for Boys Town. So he absolutely had this incredible impression and effect that continues to reverberate throughout the world. And you're right, at the very center of this was God's love. And you couldn't outpray this man. And you know, when you talk to people that knew him in his lifetime, you read his writings, you know that the gospel was the air that he breathed. And it was the air that he exhaled, and he put that, you know, helped to reflect Christ and God's love to the world, and it informed his choices, it fueled his motivation, it pushed him through all his illnesses to basically go out and pour himself out for every child that needed his help. And I tell you, I think, you know, when we talk about what the world needs now, we need more of that, and he's an incredible role model for all of us to see what good we can do and what greatness and holiness we can bring to this world by putting our total faith in the gospel and to try to live it and be informed by it in all our circumstances that we face every day.
Amen. And one of the ways the Catholic Church does that is through the canonization process, that we hold these men and women of heroic virtue up as the standard bearers for the rest of us. And we're going to take a short break, Steve, and then when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about that process and where you are in it with Father Flanagan. Again, my guest is Stephen Wolfe, and we're talking about Father Edward Flanagan, the founder of Boys Town. And in the second half of the show, we'll get into that canonization process. So we're only going to take a short break. Don't go away. We're coming right back.
We thank God for our one, holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church, where Jesus remains present to us until the end of the age, in word and in sacrament. Catholic Radio shares in the ministry of the Church to proclaim the gospel to the ends of the earth. And in his sign, Catholic Radio, has been doing so for over 30 years. Kathleen McCarthy and In His Sign have been empowered by the Holy Spirit to bring the fire of God's healing love to the world through Catholic radio and the internet. With God's grace, His word goes out, healing hearts and transforming lives. In His Sign, proclaims the culture of life loud and clear in a culture of death. The ministry's mission is to evangelize, catechize, and to be a voice for those who have no voice, proclaiming the truth that will set all people free. To our faithful family and friends who stand with us, thank you for being missionaries with us by supporting In His Sign Catholic Radio. Without your monthly support, of prayer and financial giving, our mission would not be able to continue. Our mission voice would be silenced. To our new listeners, please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010. Or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. Again, your host, Ken Johnston. I'll be with you for the next 27 minutes or so. And just a reminder, on Sunday, April 22nd, we'll be having our annual Wake Up America dinner, a great and much-needed fundraiser we have here for In His Sign Radio. Again, Sunday, April the 22nd, 1:30 to 5:30 at the Malvern Retreat House. The cost is $55 per person or $400 for a table of eight. Worth every penny. Come on out. We'll rub elbows and break bread together and enjoy a delicious meal. We'll have a couple of speakers there for you, as well as a silent auction in order to raise much-needed funds to keep this great radio apostolate on the air. My guest today is Stephen Wolf, and we've been talking about Father Edward Flanagan, the founder of Boys Town. In the first half of the show, we pretty much covered his life from his roots in Ballymoe, Ireland, to coming to the United States and eventually landing in Omaha, Nebraska, where he would found Boys Town, which eventually would impact thousands and thousands of children and obviously other people as well that came to be aware of his communities and the work that he was doing with these children. And right before the break, we talked about his passing in Germany. And right now, one of the things that got our attention and why we asked Stephen to join us on the radio was that the cause for the canonization of Father Flanagan has been opened. And it can be a long and tedious process. I've shared from time to time about the status of the cause for Venerable Matt Talbot. You know, this guy, he's got millions of miracles with people in recovery, but you can't document them that they were a drunk one day and sober the next as a result of somebody's prayer. So we're struggling to get miracles for Matt Talbot. Father Flanagan is in the early stages of that process, I believe, and Stephen is the vice postulator of his cause for canonization. So in that role, Steve, I believe that you then work with the postulator in Rome and coordinating all the documentation and evidence that's needed in order to keep the process going?
Yes, that's correct. And I tell you, it's been quite a fascinating, really incredible experience to learn what really goes on with the church's discernment of those that they hold up for the rest of us as a guidepost to how to live a holy and virtuous life. And so we're really excited that right now the cause is moving quite well. We officially opened the cause, our Archbishop George Lucas with the Archdiocese of Omaha. We're so grateful that he accepted our petition to open the cause, and that happened in 2012. And interestingly enough, one of Father Flanagan's patron saints or great role models was St. Patrick, and his cause was opened on St. Patrick's Day in 2012. And we were very fortunate that the first phase, the diocesan investigation or the local investigation, where we're really, you know, the church is trying to figure out like putting Father Flanagan on trial for his life through a tribunal system, investigating whether he really did have, examples of heroic virtue in his life, and doing a theological examination, historical examination, just trying to get anything that on paper or whatever that, you know, anything he ever said or did in public from the time he was born till the time he passed. So that process, fortunately, only took us about 3 years. And I think, you know, that part of an investigation can take decades. But what we're very fortunate about is that one of Father Flanagan's successors at Boys Town, Father Monsignor Robert Hupp, actually hired a historian back around the 1980 time frame. And if that hadn't happened, you know, all the work that historian has been doing for the last couple of decades would have had to have started almost originally by us in 2012. So we really had the benefit of an amazing archive that had been collected over two decades, and that really helped to speed that local investigation up. And so the case was sent to Rome in 2015, and we just heard about a year ago now, in 2017, in January 2017, we received something that this is kind of an important step in a canonization process that people don't really know about. And what we received is a thing called a decree of judicial validity. And what that was saying to us, and what the church was pronouncing, is that we have a solid case for this to move forward to possible venerability. A lot of causes, what ends up happening when they send the case to Rome, if they don't get that decree, two other things could possibly happen. Either the case is sent back to the diocese that opened the investigation, and they have to do more work and fill in some blanks and some gaps, or the Vatican says, no, there's nothing else to pursue here. There's, you know, all the things that we would look for to carry the cause forward are absent, and, you know, this is it. And that person would, you know, at that stage simply remain a servant of God. So getting that decree of judicial validity was incredibly good news, and it let us know that the Vatican feels that there is substantive evidence of his heroic virtue. And what we're in the phase of right now is that there's a person called a relator, or someone, I call him a relator in my own broken English here, or broken Italian. But this person is going to relate all those case files in a more condensed document called a positio. And the positio is essentially a position paper that is making the final closing argument for Servant of God Flanagan's heroic virtue. And this argument will be made in front of three separate groups of cardinals and bishops at the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. So we're at the positio is in its final stages of completion right now. And I've been very feverishly sending over all the documentation we have of the 21 alleged miracles that have been reported to us. And that information is going in so that in the argument we can show that there is an active prayer life and an active devotion around Servant of God Flanagan, and that he is being actively, asked to be an intercessor with prayers before Christ. And we're hoping that the congregation will complete that work probably later this spring, perhaps in the May-June time frame. And what we hope to then have happen would that, you know, and we can't presuppose what the church is ultimately going to decide, but we're hoping that they will, in fact, ask the Pope to declare him venerable. And how cool would that be if maybe that happens by the time Pope Francis goes to Ireland for the World Meeting on Families in August in Ireland, to have that announced in Father Flanagan's native homeland. We're just very prayerful that we might have something like that for him to announce by that time.
It's beautiful, and it's I had a similar story with Venerable Matt Talbot, who, of course, was Irish, and when Pope Francis was here in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, we had I had folks here from Idaho, and I was explaining to them who Matt Talbot was and his cause for canonization, and, you know, how we're just these been made venerable, but we're just stuck trying to get a miracle or two. And you know, the people, when they at the end of the Mass on Sunday, when Pope Francis was here, they announced that the next World Meeting of Families would take place in Ireland. Well, the folks from Idaho looked at me and they're like, "Venerable Matt Talbot's getting canonized," and it's like, and I think part of that was because when he came here to the States, that they was for the canonization of Junipero Serra, and so it would only make sense that something big happened for Ireland when Pope Francis gets there. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be Venerable Matt Talbot, but it would certainly be awesome to have Servant of God Flanagan raised to the venerable level. And you say that they're already looking at 21 miracles?
Well, yeah, and we have to be, you know, officially involved in the cause. We have to be very careful to how we characterize this, because so you'll hear me use the term alleged or potential right. miracle, because in our church, only the Pope can declare a miracle. So I don't use that term loosely, because I don't want to jeopardize the cause by announcing any presumption there.
Right.
But yes, we've had, we've had kind of more hearsay and, you know, and grapevine type of reports of alleged miracles. But we've had, people that have formally reached out and contacted us and, you know, and have been willing to put, you know, their information into writing and things like that. We've had 21 alleged miracles reported to us, and this started even before the Archbishop of Omaha, Archbishop George Lucas, even accepted our petition. We were having alleged miracles reported to us. So we have to investigate some of these. We're looking for some cases where there's a complete, total, instantaneous, effect. This can't be something, typically the church is not going to look at something where somebody was getting, let's say someone suffering from cancer and they were taking chemotherapy, things like that. We're not questioning that through these prayers and intercessions, these people are receiving graces and that they've survived these things
mm-hmm.
That have afflicted them. But those typically are not the kinds of cases where the church is going to say that's a total instant spontaneous healing. And so out of the 21, we have a handful of those that really do look like incredible cases. And so we've had two tribunals open so far, and we're looking to possibly open a couple more this spring and try to get those cases taken care of as quickly as possible and moved on to Rome as well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I didn't mean to mislead anyone, because we had the same thing happen with us with Matt Talbot. We had an alleged miracle not too far from you in over in Kansas. And it was actually, it started in either Omaha or Lincoln. There's a Matt Talbot kitchen there. But anyway, somebody had learned about Matt Talbot there and prayed for a baby that was apparently struggling in utero and was supposed to be born with all kinds of issues. And to the point where they had planned to medevac the child from a rural area to the city to get help as soon as it was born. And when it was born, it was perfectly healthy. And they gathered all the evidence and sent it over to Rome. And like you said, they didn't buy that instantaneous healing took place, that that couldn't have happened any other way but through a miracle. So we're back to square one, trying to get them off venerable to blessed. And I think that's a good thing, in that especially for those that aren't Catholic and don't understand the process, and think that we may canonize anyone and everyone, that there really is a pretty stringent process. And by the time you're able to get Father Flanagan through it and others have gotten folks to the point where they're actually canonized, they are scrutinized, like you said, from birth to death, everything they said, wrote, anything that can be found about these folks. So when we hold them up as saints and recognize that because of their heroic virtue and their heroic lives and the things that they've done, that we're assured that they're in heaven and are canonized saints, that then they can be held up for us. And especially when you take somebody like the life of Father Flanagan, here, you know, like you said, he was a guy that wasn't expected to do well in seminary, and does, and so oftentimes God raises up people that may not be the Harvard PhDs or the, you know, the smartest kids in the class, but it'll take us where we are and give us and qualify us to do the things that he needs us to do. And I don't think there's a much better example of that than there is in Father Flanagan.
Yeah, I think you know, the thing that I like about the church, and I'm by the way, I'm a convert, and Father Flanagan certainly played a role in this. Something happened later in my adult life, but you know, he definitely influenced my conversion and really kind of coming out of a bit of an agnostic period of my life and really bringing me back to Christ. And I think the thing, you know, about this process, you know, from somebody who was an outsider looking and said, oh, what are those Catholics doing with these saints and things like that, is the rigor and the seriousness and the depth of the scrutiny that goes into this process. And that you can really know that if you take the time to look at the life of the saints, that you will find, and I think what's helpful, for example, with Father Flanagan, he in some ways may be so much more relatable to people in the here and now, because the society and the conditions of society that he dealt with are still with us in a very right now modern way. And you know, it may be difficult for some people to relate to somebody from 1500 years ago, and to see how Father Flanagan applied the gospel in his own life and his outreach to the people that he encountered and the challenges, and to the positive effect that he did of not only saving mortal lives but bringing more souls to Christ, it's just really incredibly helpful to know that when these people are held up, that they are really providing us tangible guideposts of how to live a holy life ourselves, and that it is doable in this time and place right now. And I think that's one thing that's very appealing about Servant of God Flanagan, Matt Talbot, and, you know, and so many of these others that are, you know, going through this process and have been recently canonized. You know, Christ is with us. Christ wants to be with us and act in our lives right now, and these folks are showing us how to do that, and how to trust that we can walk in the footsteps of the Lord, and it'll be okay.
Amen. We got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to give out the phone numbers just in case anybody's got a question about Father Flanagan or the canonization process. The number is 610-527-2906, 610-527-2906. Where if you're listening to us from a distance, maybe over our website at inhissign.com, you can get us toll-free, 888-34-FAITH, 888-343-2484. So that was one of the things that I didn't mention in your bio in the beginning of the show, but I had read that you were a convert to the Catholic faith. And so it sounds like Father Flanagan also has a role in that, and that's important because it shows not only that he led a heroic life while he was here and the people that he worked with directly, but still having an impact on many people such as yourself in bringing souls to the feet of Christ.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things I would encourage your listeners to do. I think, you know, he certainly has a bit of a familiarity, you know, in the United States still and around the world. But I would encourage people to visit our website, fatherflanagan.org, to learn more about him. Because, again, I think, you know, he provides us some guideposts and some encouragements and some things that we can all relate to that could help us and to help others. And so I think that's, you know, his mission work, because of the grace of God, you know, Christ is still working through him with us right now. And I think he's a great inspiration and role model for people. And I certainly believe too, that, you know, he's somebody that can help lead more people to the vocation of religious life and really help us be an intercessor for a lot of needs that we all face in the society today.
I couldn't agree with you more. So how does a person go from not even being a member of the Catholic faith to becoming the vice postulator for the cause of somebody's canonization? How did you get? How did you come to get involved in that process?
Oh boy, you know, I think that there were some things that right tied to the time I was asked to get involved by the Boys Town National Alumni Association president, a gentleman by the name of Ken Suddeth, who, by the way, you know, a former Boys Town boy who was a Korean War orphan, and by the grace of God, he found his way to Boys Town. Ken had this idea that, you know, we needed to do things to hold Father Flanagan up to the world and you know, show him for what we believe to be the saint that you know, we think he is, and also to do something to try to memorialize him in Ireland, because all these generations of boys and now girls that went through his mission work at Boys Town, we wanted to make sure that his native people never forgot that, in our opinion, he's one of the greatest sons of Ireland ever. And so we wanted to do something to help, you know, recognize him and make sure those folks don't forget who they sent here, over here to the States to save us. And it was in that process that some very profound things would happen that would make me, I mean, just somebody could say something, I could see something, and it made me immediately stop and start thinking about my relationship with Christ, or maybe at that point kind of the lack thereof. And I had been asked to get very involved in that memorial project, and I started to, as time wore on, these coincidental things I realized weren't a coincidence, and that I could tell, like, Christ is calling me to something. And it took me a while to finally figure out that this memorial project had something to do with the canonization effort, which at the time I wasn't exactly a part of. I knew what was going on, but being a non-Catholic, I said, like, you know, go do that thing and have fun with it. But I really went through a radical conversion as a result of these things happening, and I just finally realized, okay, I think you're calling me to the Catholic Church, and there's nothing I can do to memorialize Father Flanagan if I'm not doing it with Christ at the center of my life. And you know, and I better be going to that church that Christ founded, and that produced the likes of Father Flanagan. So that's, you know, kind of in a nutshell what happened there. And after that conversion, I've just been on fire with this, and it's just been one of the most amazing graces of my life to help lift this man up, and seeing what happens to people when they actually take in and contemplate his motivation. Because when you contemplate Father Flanagan's motivation, I promise you, you're going to see Christ in his life, and it's going to change yours as a result.
Wow. And you're well spoken, Stephen, and to be able to explain it, and I'm sure our listeners have learned much more about Father Flanagan, but to hear in your own words and in your own voice the impact that he's had on you and this whole process, and how God works. I mean, what you said was you realized that these weren't coincidences. We have a term for it in a couple of circles I run around in, where we say, is that odd or is that God? And it sounds like you've had many of those moments, and I'm so happy that God has brought you along the way he has. And not that it just that he's brought you along, but he does that for so many people in so many ways, but he doesn't force it upon us that sooner or later we have to give our own yes to what's being asked of us. So I personally want to thank God for your yes and your willingness to do the work that you've done. And you're just a great spokesman for Father Flanagan and the life that he led and the work that he did. And I can't help but think, especially since you have a number of these alleged miracles, that it won't be too long down the road until we're talking about Saint Edward Flanagan.
And, amen, brother.
Yeah, man. So I know what it's like to wait. I've been involved with this Matt Talbot thing for 10 years, and every time you think you have something and you don't, it's like, what do we got to do, God? I mean, this is a guy we can hold up for millions of addicts and alcoholics to look to. But we think it's just Matt's way of remaining humble. But anyway.
You know, Ken, it's funny you say that because you ask anybody that knows me quite well, and especially before my conversion and getting involved with this cause, patience was not a virtue of mine. And I can't believe, you know, I mean, we've been involved with this now since for going on some 17 years.
Yeah.
And I can't even believe I've still got this much energy and passion, but I'm slowly but surely marinating in patience here, hopefully that will ultimately be one of my greatest virtues. So, you know, I can thank Father Flanagan for getting some of that into my life.
There you go. And especially with a wife in it. Is it five girls that you have?
Yeah.
God bless you, brother. Yeah, Father Flanagan must be looking out for you. I've got four kids, two boys and two girls. I can't imagine a house full of five girls. So that's wonderful.
Yes, I'm blessed among women.
There you go. There you go. Well, we only got a couple of minutes left. So before we go, any final words that you want to impart to our listeners?
Yes. I would encourage people take some time to learn more about Father Flanagan. But quite frankly, anyone that's currently going through a canonization process, and certainly those that have already been, because they're there to help us with our journey to the Lord. And I think Father Flanagan said it best himself when he said, pray for prayers work miracles. And we all need miracles. Mm-hmm. And miracles are that love and relationship that God and grace that God wants to pour into each and every one of us. So I do encourage everyone to pray and pray big too. Don't pray for little things. Pray for God to take away our hurt, take away the things that are keeping us from being healthy. Just take it all away, and God will reward our faith. So I would encourage people to pray, and hopefully they'll pray with Father Flanagan's intercession and stay in touch and be involved with our effort, if not ours, certainly Matt Talbot's and the other ones that are going on out there.
Very good. Again, my guest has been Stephen Wolf. He's the vice postulator for the cause for canonization of Father Edward Flanagan, the founder of Boys Town and now servant of God. So, Stephen, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about Father Flanagan. And it's been really informative for me, and I'm sure for our listeners. And again, that website is fatherflanagan.org, and they'll keep it up to date as this process continues. So thank you, Stephen, for being with us. And maybe at some point in the not-too-distant future, we'll have you back, and we can talk about the actual canonization.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you, Ken. And I wish all your listeners a blessed Lent, and just thank you for this opportunity to share this great news about this great man.
Thank you, Stephen. Take care. God bless.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. So, brothers and sisters, we're beginning the Lenten season. We talked in during Saints and Sinners about some of the things you can might be able to add to your life during the season in preparation for Easter. Maybe one of them will be to check out Father Flanagan or Matt Talbot or some of these others that are in the process of being canonized and learn about their lives and what they did so heroically that the church has started them along the canonization process. So it's always my pleasure to be here on Wednesdays and spend a couple hours with you. I hope you've enjoyed being with us. I want to thank Frank, our engineer, for getting the sound waves out over the air, and Maureen for all the work that she does for us here at In His Sign. We'll be back again next Wednesday with two more shows. And until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless. Thank you.